We're listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, just wafting in after a spectacularly wonderful journey to Turkey, guided by a great dance teacher, Banafshe, women from all over, many Persian women, many Japanese dancing women, really great, again, complexity, sharing our cultures, and spiraling, whirling dervish, spiraling prayers of solace and comfort into the world. Huh. So today is the solstice, and we say, may Big Mama Grizzly return to the world this solstice. And remember David Grimes' wonderful story of a friend of his hiking in Alaska with her baby on her back, and they rounded a corner and saw a mother grizzly with her cubs who raised up like, arr! And the baby on the woman's back looked around and went, ah, and the mother grizzly said, oh, you're a mother, I'm a mother, that's cool, there we go. And in a profound, you know, ayahuasca journey, and our guest was guided to us by wonderful Rachel Harris, who wrote a great book, Listening Ayahuasca. But it was a profound journey in which all loss was turned to enormous, enormous mother love, going, oh. So the solstice is the time when, you know, Legba Mercury, the messenger, hands the baton to the moon, to Big Mama, at this time of horrific, churlish cruelty and all too imaginable heartbreak. So the solstice is a time of standing still in the center of the storm, whereby to animate the desirable guiding story. Humans have gathered at equinoxes and solstices, you know, the earliest form of really magic. You know, what's going on then? O literal and symbolic light of sun, illuminate this writing, this painting at the back of the cave. This is the desirable guiding story our community, defined in the largest embrace possible, wants to animate. The soul of the world, the anima mundi. So we say dedicated hearts attract revelatory guidance through the agency of wonder, right? Wonder. And metaphor is the incarnational garb whereby power enters the world, cooperators are standing by. And we are at such a dangerous, heart-rending, heart-opening time, and our time of greatest need. And how not to ricochet, some news commentator was saying, on the left, there's outrage, on the right, there's contempt. And we go, we want to dissolve left and right, and also, how shall we, this is a conundrum we want to practice together, you know, use outrage appropriate, roar, but to not feed the Dementors, because the Dementors love, remember our show of several weeks back with Gary Lachman, in which he delineated the tutored chaos magic of the Trump team, people knowing the power of image in a bad way with no respect for truth, feeding on outrage and polarity. So all of that. And it's you know, novels are incarnating. There was a powerful New York Times opinion piece of a man who, after the election in 2016, had written a dystopian novel in which Donald Trump then imprisoned children, and he said to his great dismay, this story had incarnated into actual reality. You know, I've been saying for the longest time right now that, you know, it is a time of manifesting the eager, Saturn structure, trines Uranus, wildness in Earth, eager to incarnate. But that's available to the Dementors as much as to good people. So we go, right, so let us be The Antidote. And it is like the darkest of Philip Pullman novels, for those of you who might have read his Dark Matter material and The Golden Compass, in which the worst aspects of the church and the state were generating energy by separating children from their daemon, from their spirit. We go, oh, the reports are coming in. And things we stand up to and for, we go, no, we will not rest. We will not forget until every child is reunited back to a loving embrace against all odds. And the reports come in from many of these concentration camps, really, in which children against their will have been given powerful pharmaceuticals going, they seem restless and they seem unhappy. We'll give them, no. So we're here to metabolize, step into the center of the storm, to metabolize conniption fits, you know, and not ricochet between to feed those who have contempt. No, it just never stops. Melania got on a plane to the Mexican border wearing a shirt that says, I don't really care, do you? It's like, whoa, holy bleeping demonic moly, whoa. You know, and the language that Trumple Stiltskin had used, going, the heart is weak. And we go, oh, that goes all the way back to Skull and Bones, the initiatory process whereby men were granted financial and political power, in which they actually do a black magic ritual in which they say, this sense of feeling, it is weakness, and I kill it now. So we've been outsourcing our leadership to those who have killed kinship, right, until now. Tide wants to turn. So we do turn to the guiding of all esoteric traditions and our wonderful guest, Solstice aligning with the Anima Mundi, the world soul, at this time of heartbreak, heart rising. We call upon heretical liberating esoterica that we may be pragmatic mystics dreaming the desirable world into being. So we welcome Tom Cheatham, the author of Green Man, Green Angel, All the World an Icon, Henri Corbin and the Angelic Function of Beings, The World Turned Inside Out, Henri Corbin and Islamic Mysticism, After Prophecy and a Wild Book of His Poems, Boundary Violations. Tom has been called a rogue scholar of the imagination in esoteric Islam, and we have a shared ally in Michael Lerner, the president of Commonweal, who says Tom Cheatham shows the heights that independent scholars outside academia can achieve. His prior work has virtually defined independent scholarship on Henri Corbin. In Imaginal Love, he has turned his gifts to the meanings of imagination in James Hillman. Yay, come on in, James, ancestor, and Henri Corbin. The result is a powerful contribution to our understanding of the full meaning of imaginal love and the central role of such love in human life. He's a fellow of the Temenos Academy in London and former associate professor of biology and environmental studies at Wilson College. He speaks and gives workshops regularly in Europe and the U.S. His website is tomcheatham.blogspot.com. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's delightful to be here. Can you hear me okay?
No. Let's see how our listeners sound. You sound a little bit underwater, but we will experiment and call on the gods to open it up. So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it can be. But you're okay, and I will be in touch backstage with Board Op. So how does it sound to you, oh great Board Op, and also listening public too? We will persevere. And do I sound okay to you?
Yeah, you sound terrific to me, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, we're going to think of you as coming from the dream world. We'll reframe, we'll make this work. So your book, Imaginal Love, was a great companion in Turkey. And as I mentioned to you backstage, every now and then I read a great deal of it and would open it up, just bibliomancy as well. And I always opened up to the passage about Moses and Kadir. Do you remember this great part of your book?
Yeah, I actually do.
Oh, your voice is good now. Oh, that's great.
Okay, yeah. Our technical friends have done something, perhaps?
Perhaps. The angels. We want to bring in the angels, too, but it's working. Okay. It's working. That's great. Okay, so Moses and Kadir, a friend, the Persian people said... The Persian ally said, oh, they changed the K, and my friend Banafshe did give me a little recording, I think it might work, about how Kadir is known in Farsi, in Persian, and then it's followed by Rend, which is her word for trickster, but she says it's this sound here.
Khizr, Rend.
There we go. So it's Hrez. I can't quite do it. But Moses and Kadir, because I told you I was, you know, Moses encounters Kadir. We encounter the guide at these places of confluence, like we are calendrically and literally of where two oceans meet. And I was in Istanbul when I read that, and I was like, I am where two oceans meet. And then, you know, Kadir is the liberator of Moses, right?
Right. Yeah. And I suppose the thing to say about that, I mean, given your introduction placing us in difficult contemporary times, one of the overarching goals of Corbin's work was to counteract fundamentalisms of all kinds. And that story about Khidir and Moses is one of the stories that he takes to be emblematic of a situation which he often calls spiritual birth, which in Jungian terms corresponds to individuation. And what that particular story is about is, oh, what Corbin calls elsewhere a visionary recital, at the end of which you encounter your celestial twin. In this particular case, it takes in the form of Kadir, but for Corbin, each of us has such a celestial twin, one of whose functions is to individuate us, but by so doing, this figure releases us from a strict reliance on the letter of the law in this particular case, and frees us towards what he calls spiritual hermeneutics, which is a particular kind of spiritual awakening which must occur individually. It's never an institution. Institutional phenomenon. It's never a phenomenon of, it's never mediated by any kind of priestly class. It's always right. A meeting between you and your celestial twin. And in this particular story, in Shura 18, what Corbin is emphasizing is that here is Moses, the bearer of the law, finding out that there's a level beyond that and encountering his personal guide who shows him the way beyond literalism. And for right. Corbin, that's equivalent to the way beyond any kind of fundamentalism.
That's beautiful. Right, because I did point out that passage in your book in which, again, you're quoting from the Quran, Shura 18, and it's very trippy and heartening, and Kadir is the green man, and in my own imperfect translation of what you wrote, but what seems to be there as a message, you know, Kadir says to Moses, you know, your gig, Sharia law, and these commandments, you know, this is an impediment. Let me liberate you from that into, you know, direct mystical Islam, and you're right, unmediated. And you know what we spoke about backstage, you know, the restoration of intimacy to the world, right? And it was great because all the wonderful Iranian women were like, that's in the Quran? Really? That's great. And I showed them your book. I go, right there. And they're like, yes, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is, you know, and I did climb Mount Sinai last year, and I go, I'm not bringing down rules. Let's bring down trickster guidelines, for goodness sake. But
that's right.
Well, that is one of the great mysteries of you know, I've been confounded in talking to Islamic scholars and many in between going, he goes out into the desert and he comes back with rules, really? And they're like, yes, it's a kind of confounding thing. But here's the antidote that you've written about and that you love in Henri Corbin, which is liberating, heretical, right? Heretical means free thinking, right? So the liberating of the teachings themselves.
Well, that's right. And we did talk backstage a little bit. It's worth pointing out that one of the... Boy, it's been a long time since I've talked a lot about Corbin explicitly, so this is good practice for me. One of the really great themes of his work is what he called the Harmonia Abrahamica. Corbin's very difficult to read because he presumes an enormous amount of knowledge, and he's multilingual in the extreme, and he's steeped in medieval theology and philosophy. So forgive him for calling it the Harmonia Abrahamica. What he's referring there is to what he saw as the unifying underlying truth beneath or above, if you want, or both, the three religions of Abraham, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And he says it's precisely in their heresies where they unite. So it is paradoxical. Corbin's kind of a wild man in his in some respects he was pretty conservative by, you know, 21st century standards, but in others I think it's not unfair to see him as a kind of forerunner of even a kind of postmodern pluralism. Because
what does that mean? Abstract. What is postmodern pluralism?
Well, he wanted to free these religions from their legalisms, from their constraints by laws, and the countervailing argument there is, well, if we don't have the laws, then the danger is chaos. All right, I don't want to get too far afield here, but because this is crucial, it seems to me, to this distinction between fundamentalism and heresy. I mean, because you were using the word heresy here in Islam and Judaism and in Buddhism and in Christianity and every religion, every large scale religion that has become institutionalized, and they all do, the institution is always really worried about heresy, always worried about the nuts on the fringes, because those mystical heretics on the fringes threaten to do exactly what the trickster does, which is to blow things apart. And Corbin wanted to find commonality among these Abrahamic religions in their heretical fringes. And that's a really postmodern kind of move. That is, it privileges what looks to be chaos over what looks to be order.
Imposed order. Yeah, the con of actual order.
Sure, imposed order. Yeah. I guess it's in the Green Man book where I try to riff a little bit on the comparison between Ivan Illich and Henri Corbin. And I try to come to terms to some degree with this fundamental archetypal tension between order and disorder. I won't even say chaos because that's got too negative a ring. If you're a leader of an institution of any sort, government, business, religion, it only works at a public level if the wheels are pretty well greased and everybody knows their place and most people behave. Corbyn's notion is that that's a really lousy way to run a religion. And yet he's perfectly well aware of the fact that such structures are humanly inevitable and to some degree necessary. But he is always trying to make us aware that the real personal, moral, and spiritual core of all of these religions lies in the heart of the individual and is only there, and that the religions are only alive in the hearts of individuals, and that the institutions are only there in order to provide a framework for these living hearts.
Right, but it is the individual, each one of us, connected, you know, in our own unique way to the whole big everything. Right.
That's
so
right.
It's not henna on a hunky, I've got mine, because I said backstage, it's like at this time we want to tease, aspire to tease or wonder or waft, you know, all of this into pertinence. What do we do now if part of the Skyer story says the protoplasm of reality is especially receptive to imaginative imprint, you know, and that idea of, you know, composting the, you know, tyrannical aspects of the Abrahamic traditions or any tradition, including, I mean, everything really, and where it's, you know, demonically, you know, in this horrific cartoon of the Trump administration, in which that's like, forget religion, we just have law, you know, and law is, you know, again, to separate and to harm and to, you know, just, it's an incredibly cruel cartoon, but it's, I gave you the Jung quote that I like so much too, in which Jung said, fanaticism is always shouted down doubt, right, which is very useful.
Yeah.
Right, and so there's a lot of yelling of certainty and the thriving on harmful, you know, chaos. The chaos magicians, as Gary Lachman would call them, who thrive on, again, the opposition, the outrage, the chaos, the kind of all of that. So as an antidote, yeah, to, well, all the great beings and your love of the dedication of Henri Corbin, you know, as a crosser of borders, and that's a very important part of your book, Imaginal Love, the crossing of borders and thresholds. You say we have to cross them many times, like in a fairy tale, right?
Yes, indeed. I'm drawing on personal experience there and lots of experiences. But any time we become conscious of something that we were unconscious of before, we're crossing a border from not knowing into knowing. And for me, one of the most revealing instances of that in my own life was the very slow encounter with what Jung calls a complex. And this is all pertinent, but it's really hard to put together. You were talking about rage, and anger and all those negative emotions.
Well, outrage.
Right. Yeah. Well, outrage on our part, but rage and anger and negativity on the other side. Those Jung will tell you that those, and any time you're in the grip of a strong emotion, you're in a complex. And the complex has you. You don't have it. And in my life, one of the strong, well, it's not quite an emotion, but I struggled with a form of depression for a very long time. And I didn't perceive it as depression. I just thought the world was that way. And what happens, and for me, this is the archetypal instance of it. For other people, it would be other experiences. But over a course of many years, I would go into the depression and come back out. And when you're in it, rage, for any really strong emotion or any fundamental feeling about the truth of things, even that, when you're in it, it is everything. There are no other options. And then when you're out of it, you can see, oh no, that was just me thinking, feeling. And that kind of border crossing, such that when you're in whatever it is the whole world, and you take it literally, and you move across the border back out of it, and you realize that it's not the entire world, or it's not the only emotion, or it's not the only truth. It's contingent, and it's yours. And this is very, it seems to me now, without claiming to know very much about Buddhism, but it seems to me now that this is very much what meditation teaches, to not take your complexes literally, take them metaphorically. And the only way, it seems to me, well, I don't want to say that, but a way, for me, maybe the only way, to become conscious of my own blind spots, foibles, is to move back and forth across that kind of psychosomatic border repeatedly until you begin to be able to get some handle on it. And you can say, oh, there's something that I can choose to deal with rather than be in the grasp of. And I think that's not just, I think that's not just, as Corbin would have it, that's not just Corbin would talk specifically about those kinds of boundary crossings as issues of spiritual advancement in his sort of standard hierarchical scale. But I think it's much better to understand those boundary crossings as happening all the time in normal daily life, much more in the Buddhist sense, that you should be aware of your awareness all the time, if that's possible. So that it seems to me that Jung and certain kinds of Buddhist practice are simply trying to tell us to pay really close attention. I think it's Pema Chodron who says, you know, any emotion, any feeling has only got a half-life of 3 or 4 minutes, and it's going to disappear unless we hang on to it. And,
right.
I think that, at least for me, it's been really useful to conceive of fundamentalisms as desperate attempts to hang on to something. And that comes back to your Jung quote there.
Right. And we might say, I mean, again, the individual separated by a thin membrane from the collective, you know, whatever we do for ourselves grants us the spiritual muscle tone to participate in the world in some way. And when you speak of depression, I mean, part of the being moved by so much and the individual and the vast and all that's going on, but the suicide of Anthony Bourdain and his dance with depression. And part of me as an astrologer is, you know, we know that we have these deep appointments that can be depression. And as you say, it feels compelling, like it will never end and this is all there is. And it's like, no, it ends on Friday, Anthony, just, oh, phooey. You know, and then also our experimental responsibility to waft out into the world to all whose hearts are broken, whose children have been stripped from them, who are, you know, victims of the war on life, which seems so relentless, to, you know, a wafting well-wishing.
Without letting it overwhelm you. I mean, that's one of the grave dangers here in this political environment, is that it just gets to be so much you just can't stand it anymore. And that's one of the places where I think this kind of Jungian / Buddhist or whatever, I mean, you can find it in any tradition, attempt to distance yourself from your passions just a little bit so that you can say, okay, this is, in this particular case that we're talking about with these children, I mean, you have to be able to say, okay, it's so bad, I can't even stand it. But I'm going to kind of suppress those feelings. I'm going to hang on to the outrage.
I just want to replace suppress with metabolize, alchemize, you know, and all that. Hold that thought, because we're going to take a very short break and come right back in that. This is the Visionary Activist Show. I'm Caroline Casey. Our guest today is Tom Cheatham, author of innumerable invaluable books, including Imaginal Love. And we'll be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Chanty, chanty, come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our guest guide today is Tom Cheatham, author of 5 books at least. The one that I am most familiar with, Imaginal Love, The Meanings of Imagination in Henri Corbin and James Hillman, and aspiring to tease into our individual psyches and its connection to group mind that we can, yeah. So right where we left off and left you holding. That's right. We do want to come. Well, the solstice is where, like Kuan Yin, we step into the center of the storm, not whacked around the edges in reactivity, honoring outrage and grief. But that's where you have a great etymology in your book, which is apatheia was a good thing, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I think, okay, sure. And what I wanted to say following on that was that alchemy and meditation are very much allied, it seems to me. And Jung thought so too. I just recently was reminded that he was working on his Red Book from 1913 to 1928, and so he was deep into his own alchemical imaginings, and it was then that he was shown a copy of The Secret of the Golden Flower, which was a Chinese alchemical meditative technique that can't remember his name offhand, had just translated. And so Jung provided an introduction for that, and it was clear to Jung that alchemical imagining and meditation were, at least in that one instance, engaged in very much the same kind of process of producing a transformation of the passions. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's one of the things that's really started to become clear to me. Well, no, nothing is clear to me, but one of the but one of the problems with being human is that there's so much fire, and fire is in us and around us, and fire is so ambiguous. It's the warmth required for cooking. It's the fire in the heart. It's the fire in the mind. But it's also conflagration and destruction and death. And it's when it's controlled properly, it's absolutely essential for life, period. But it tends, we and it tend to get out of control. It controls the wrong word, but alchemy and meditation and all sorts of other spiritual disciplines with which I am unfamiliar are often explicitly devoted to learning how to control these fires. At the same time that the world lights up with and you light up with wonder, wonders to behold. In Homer, it's thaumata idesthai. The gods would come down and they would be wonders to behold, and they would light up everything. Those fires light up in us, but then we also have our passions, and Jung is pretty good about describing alchemy and the alchemical vessel as the place where you learn to deal with those passions without acting out. And so that's what I was trying to get at when I was saying you need to control or suppress your outrage. But no, you're exactly right. You need to work it. I am increasingly frustrated by my own inability to adequately articulate what people seem to be calling the granularity of all this these days. We have so many abstract words when, in fact, reality at its most, what should I say, most impressive, most exciting, and most wonderful, is all about what Blake called the minute particulars. That's why there are poets. Poets do not use abstract terms. Who does? Scientists, politicians, theologians, propagandists. That's one of the things that we were talking about this beforehand. One of the things that as aficionados of the imagination that we should all be really aware of now is the way words are being used and the way images are being used and the way abstract terms are being used in place of abstract and depersonalizing terms are being used in place of precise and personifying terms in this political discourse.
Right, but there's also the demonic use of which Spanky, I'll call him Spanky, does too, talking about infestation by foreigners, and that's very specific. But what I'm so taken with in your writing and your dedication, is this teasing forth. You write, fanaticism and extremism are our own impulsive and compulsive anger. So we might make the distinction between reaction, which is a prison, and response, which is a freedom, and cultivating a ever larger realm of responses. But you say, you say, then they seem not merely the urges of private inner demons, but they wear a public face that can be displayed and marketed to an audience. Well, we're there. Right? That's why so much of your dedication, Henri Corbin, and the excavation of, you know, that which he and then you find liberating about esoteric Islam. I want to toss it back to you in one sentence here, or something of it so imminently too, which is because everybody I've mentioned that to is like, oh yes, you know, wherever there's too much Mars kind of and fundamentalism and shouted down doubt and certainty and cruelty, you know, calls for the Venus, the art, the poet, the dancing, you know, the liberating esoterica of Islam. So anywhere you want to go with that, because that seems really important to now, and people are kind of hungry for that. What is the liberating, you know, I mean, it's huge, it's your whole life and many people's lives, but the liberating aspect of esoteric Islam?
Oh, well, of esoteric Islam in particular, yeah, I'm gonna beg off of that one, because okay. but I'm gonna answer the question, but
are you there? Beg off the question, we lost the call. Come back. Oops. All right. Well, there we have that. All right. Our guest, his words are powerful. I'm going to beg off the question. His line went dead, but Tom Meacham will be returning shortly. May it be so. But there is much before our council. Again, we will amble on together until Tom rejoins us too. But this crucial thing, you know, I love, also years ago, a colleague taught me the etymology of symbolic, and I go, ooh, you know, and he said, sim is together and ball is to throw. So he said, either we have a symbolic way of understanding and relating to the world, or the world is diabolic, thrown apart. And that's why I think, you know, before our council, and may Tom Meacham return, we'll see. But that quality of a symbolic, which was so important to, you know, Hillman and Jung and all these mentor guys and everything, but they're really secondary sources reaching back to the originating, liberating teachings to be found everywhere, you know, about a symbolic way of relating to the world. Right, okay, exactly. We're just eager for Tom to call back, that's right. Well, we'll see. And may it be, we might even, well, we'll see if Tom rejoins us. But meanwhile, I will bring up all the things that I found so enormously useful in his work, and then how we tease it right now. You know, for the longest time I've been saying, you know, anything that has a name has a god or has a presiding intelligence. And in the liberating realms of esoteric Islam, you know, everyone and everything has an angel. And this isn't kind of fluffy unicorn New Age angel. This is, you know, a guiding and what is called the angel out of head. And what Tom writes also is that even God is thought of as having an angel out of head. And I wanted to bring this as we waft things out into the memosphere. We draw from the small and the large. A wonderful ally of mine, David Abbott, a kind, great green man soul, was a psychiatric nurse at one point in charge of a post-op room full of people who were in an institution against their will and who were strapped in after surgery, and they were all moaning and crying, you know. And he came into the room, and this is okay because he really is. He just says, I am an angel. I'm an angel of the divine sent to comfort you. And he really is, right? And if you're, let me unstrap you, there you go. We're going to evade the authorities, there you go. And you could, and just in all the ways that we want, you know, every practical way that our dedicated hearts manifests a path before us in which we can do something to reunite, you know, all of these kids and babies back to their loving arms. We're hearing from the authorities that these people may never have to see their children again. We go, no. That's one story, but the situation is so dire we can't afford the luxury of realism. We will never forget. We will not rest until we, on many levels, send angels of solace and comfort, you know, to each baby, each child, each mother, each father, the wailing of children. And it's so literalized in its horror as to be a global tipping point, may it be so, and to dissolve the false boundaries. I mean, there's, you know, you know, so many, you know, Laura Bush, welcome. You know, I mean, everybody's voice of sane reverence, at a certain point, it gets so horrific that so many people's hearts transcend their differences, and that is important now. I love, you know, Terry Pratchett saying, magic is easy. You find the fulcrum point and push. So we're at a moral fulcrum point, but this, you know, the incompetent evil of not even caring, not having a structure whereby to reunite parents with their children is so... But it does require that we just call in, do everything, and call in every power, and spiral into the memosphere as well. Not that that is sufficient, but that is a part of it, you know, the loving embrace. And we do know, you know, from that really crucial book, A General Theory of Love, by three neuroscientists. They say neurological pathways are laid down when we're very young, and they have everything to do with what happens when we cry out and how does the environment respond. And it's so crucial, it's so physical what happens. So many people who know are, you know, in anguish at the cruel, churlish, incompetent evil of separating babies and children from their parents, and what goes on there, and the wailing. And it is, you know, important of itself, the 2,300 more really, 3,700, again, everybody be restored. But it is all one thing. There is no isolated crisis. There's a crisis of isolation. It's all related to this relentless war on Earth, the drilling on Anwar, which again is a kind of mother-child devastation, the Gwich'in in Alaska, and our allies, Sarah James in the north, they call the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge the place where all life begins. It is sacred to all that is mothering within us, regardless of our temporary age, race, and gender assignment. I see just a moment here. Whoops, wait a minute. Okay, no, can't do that. We will see if we can... No, that won't work either. Pardon me one moment while my guest is trying to get back in touch with me by calling the wrong number. We'll see about that. So I'm here for 1 second. Thank you, team. We're all in this intimate thing together. No, yeah, well... All right. Well, we'll let him figure it out for the moment. Okay. You've done it. You've done it, lad. By the power of magic and everything, you're back. Thank you.
Yeah. It's sort of too bad. I was really on a roll, and I probably didn't. I don't have no idea how much of that I got through before I dropped. And it
well,
was
your very last words were, "I'm going to have to bag off on that question," and then you went away.
Are you kidding?
No, it was perfect. His words are powerful, you rogue wizard of esoteric liberating everything. Those were your exit words, and they were powerful. So careful what you say. Welcome back.
Oh, man, are you kidding? I talked for 5 minutes because I didn't beg off on that question. I could answer it again. I can give it a shot.
Let's do that.
Okay, so I'll try to do the elevator chat for what I... just did. So I'm talking about esoteric Islam and why, where the liberation lies.
This is good.
Yeah. Well, it was.
No, you can do it. You can do it. You can redo it. That was backstage. Now here we are.
Now I got it. Look, for Corbin, the Shiites are really important. Who particularly in their Iranian guise, because of the presence of the 12th or hidden imam. The imams are the leaders of the religion who were necessary after Muhammad died, and there's a long line of them. And for the Shiites, they culminate in a figure called the hidden imam, who disappeared from the earth and took off, presumably, for heaven or someplace nearby, but in any case is not in time or history, is transcendent. And it's that transcendence that's crucial for Corbin's sense of the ability. Well, it's that figure reappears as the Green Man in Shura 18, because once you've left this earth, the figure, the common figure, appears in all sorts of guises. Appears as the hidden imam, appears as Qadir, appears in Christianity, this figure is the Holy Ghost. And it's crucial for Corbin that all of these figures, also the celestial twin, that this figure is transcendent and gives a vertical connection to the individual in time and on the earth, rather than relying on a historical or social interaction. Corbin is exquisitely interested in transcendence to a degree that makes me, in fact, kind of uncomfortable. But it's important, it seems to me, to understand where he's coming from, and then determine how much of it you need or want. And that's one of the differences between Corbin and Hillman, for instance. So the sense of transcending the letter of the law and the literal fundamentalisms of reality that the figure of the Green Man confers, that freedom that the connection with the Green Man confers, is based on this figure of the 12th imam in Shiite Islam, and that performs the same function, according to Corbin, as the Holy Spirit does in Christianity. And
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, Joseph Campbell writes about the God the Father, grumpy old Yahweh, God the Son, liberating guide, Jesus, and then the era of the Holy Spirit, which was a great the Holy Ghost, which was a great heresy, in which, again, just as you're saying, each person, compost priesthoods, each person with their direct access to the vast, unique thing. So the Green Man, and we understand the Green Man and Qadir as really, you know, reverent towards the earth. Is that part of that dynamic? That the liberating esoterica in all religions underneath there, which is dedicated to stewardship.
No, that's right. I mean, you don't find any. I was going to say you don't find any specifically ecological themes in Corbin, but that's actually not true. And one of the reasons I got interested in Corbin to begin with was because of the perspective it gave me on in particular on Christianity, and on, in fact, ecological themes, because I was an ecologist at the time and teaching ecology and whatnot, and was interested in anything that would throw light on the Western history of the death of nature, as Carolyn Merchant put it long ago. And Corbin explicitly links, there's quite a few places where he explicitly links the divine face of creation to that transcendent element in all things. He has no particular interest in evolution or ecological ideas from that point of view. His veneration of nature is entirely based on its essential divinity.
Right. Well, you have a great thing where we're wending our way towards the end. But you talk about, you know, the role of the artist, and you say, you know, indigenous people have totem animals because I have it written down, but it's a great phrase that you use, or you're quoting Claude Lévi-Strauss, totem animals because we think better with animals and plants?
Good to think with.
Thank you. There we go. They're good to think with.
Yeah, and see, that comes back to the frustration I was articulating earlier about not having at my fingertips more particular terminology and being constrained by abstractions. I know that I am, that's why the Book of Poems, you know, be as particular as possible because those totem animals are good to think with, and you will know better than I think what it's like to think with those totem animals. It's always very precise and very imagistic, and that's one of the things that I know I need lots more practice. I need several more lifetimes in order to even come close to the
or an hour, but anyway, but there's many things. Okay, healing fiction. We're just bringing these names up to waft out into the world. Healing fiction is important, you know, part of the dynamic. But also, you know, you talk about you and Corbin and two kinds of darkness. You know, there's the rich replenishing dark, and then the up to no good evil dark, and we might say if one then engage the positive, the darkness of evil, then the rich darkness. And of course we're at the solstice, which is now, you know, it's the longest day, and now the days will grow darker. I mean, it's the tipping point, you know, into the nurturing, into Big Mama. Come on home to Big Mama, and everyone's heart be opened in that realm. But and then before we go, okay, we're in our last minute here, but can you do a short description of the Alam al Mithal?
No.
No, you can't. No, exactly. Fair enough. You can't. But it is the imaginal realm, right? I mean, it's the imaginal. It's. I mean, you know, we would call it, you know, the realm of all imaginings and all dreams. But it can we think of it as a dream incubation realm?
Yeah, you could also think of it as the interworld, as the Barzakh, as the rich reality. Well, for Corbin, I think this is inadequate for us these days. But for Corbin, it was the place between the abstract intellect and the senses. But I think that doesn't describe it to a modern audience very well. It's the Barzakh. It's the in between. And then, as Ibn Arabi points out, from a certain point of view, everything is in between. There is only the in between. So I think increasingly that in order to understand the Alam al-Mithal, one way to do that is to understand what the Buddhists mean by everything is illusion. Because they share a common...
All right, we're on our way out. We're on our way out on illusion, but illusion comes from in ludo, in the game, as opposed to delusion, de ludo, which is out of the game. May those who are delusional be out of the game and escorted. Thank you so much, Tom Meacham. We can think of this as a part one kahoot in your invaluable material. Thank you. And also, I will be convening for everybody a solstice telecoyote Monday night. Go to coyotenetworknews.com for more info on that, which will be posted pretty soon. Pretty soon. Thanks always to Erica Bridgman. I'm Caroline Casey, and thanks again, Tom.
You're welcome. Thank you. It was fun.
Woof woof.
Be sure to catch Apex Express on KPFA. Apex Express is a weekly program following news and cultural events throughout Asia and the Pacific Islands. Find out about issues affecting Asian American and Pacific Islander communities locally and globally. Get on board the Apex Express Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. on KPFA.
Aswat Ensemble and World Harmony Chorus invite you to Notes from Home, a Zawiya.org benefit concert for LEAP, Learning for the Empowerment and Advancement of Palestinians, featuring songs from around the world focused on themes of home, childhood, and love. The concert takes place at 7 p.m. on Saturday, June 23rd at the Islamic Cultural Center of Northern California, 1433 Madison Street in Oakland. This all-volunteer event is wheelchair accessible and features 50 performers with a mission to raise funds for a music education program, including purchasing musical instruments for youth living in the Palestinian refugee camps of Lebanon, and raise awareness of the plight of refugees all over the globe, and in particular, Palestinian refugees, now in their 70th year of displacement. For tickets, go online, notesfromhome.bpt.me, or for more info, call 510-866-5982.